From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week, we go to Cuba and Fidel Castro's reemergence on the political scene. We hear from a key player in Washington's strategy in Afghanistan. In Iraq, we examine the plight of kids orphaned in Al-Qaeda attacks. And in Italy, we vicariously enjoy a new use for wine. But we start this week's podcast with a look at the U.S. response to the catastrophic flooding in Pakistan. In Pakistan, a massive international relief effort is underway to help victims of devastating floods. The U.S. is donating $55 million, along with relief supplies and assistance. But help has been slow to reach the millions of people affected by the flooding, and now there are concerns among U.S. officials that hardline Islamist groups are capitalizing on the tragedy. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The floods, which have ravaged many parts of Pakistan, are being called the country's worst ever natural disaster. The crisis has affected some 14 million people. At least 1,500 people have died and thousands forced to flee their homes. Bad weather has hampered efforts to get aid into the stricken areas, says Mark Ward, the Obama administration's point person on international disaster relief. Ward says even helicopters used to shuttle in aid packages and run rescue missions have often had difficulty taking off.
The real problem has been the rain. None of us have been able to be as visible and get the access that we wanted because everything's been grounded. The only way we've been able to get anything around these isolated communities is by four-wheel drive and mules.
The hardest hit areas are in the northwest of the country, where the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have strongholds. That's also been the most difficult area for Pakistani and international relief workers to reach. The Pakistani government is being criticized for its slow and seemingly ineffective response to the crisis, criticism that was compounded when Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari went ahead with a European tour despite the unfolding disaster back home. Thomas Johnson, a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, says charitable organizations associated with militant Islamist groups have capitalized on the situation, providing food and shelter to people in need.
The government was very slow in responding. The army was criticized for not being able to mobilize their people fast enough and in some very volatile areas. So the Islamists have been taking advantage of this by trying to fill the gaps that the government have not been able to meet.
At least one of the Islamist groups providing relief to flood victims is associated with Lashkar-e-Taiba, the organization responsible for the 2008 terrorist attacks in Mumbai. Johnson says the radical group has charity networks already set up in parts of the country. Disaster relief coordinator Mark Ward says that's helped them respond quickly.
While it may be true that some terrorist groups have been providing some support, my guess is it's because they were already there. They haven't had any better luck with access than anybody else. But if they were already in those communities, then that's probably why they were able to act fairly quickly.
Naval Postgraduate School Professor Johnson says the Islamist groups will likely use the opportunity to feed flood victims' anger against the government.
You've had hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people that have been displaced. And whenever there are internally displaced people, the Taliban and other Islamists have been able to take advantage of this in trying to influence their behavior and their world outlook.
Christine Parthamore, a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, says the devastating floods in Pakistan represent more than just a humanitarian problem.
It's inherently a security concern just based on our troops in the region, our goals in the region, our work with allies like India in the region. Anything that destabilizes Pakistan or affects its government's ability to keep control of the country has enormous stakes for the United States on the security side.
The international relief effort for Pakistan is picking up. More countries are donating money and resources as the rains there continue. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
Now to Afghanistan. It's been nearly 2 months since General Stanley McChrystal departed Afghanistan under a cloud of controversy. He left behind a hand-picked team of counterinsurgency specialists, and among them was the man McChrystal once called the finest soldier I have ever known. Command Sergeant Major Mike Hall joined the Army Rangers in 1976 and then retired in 2008, only to be called back to Afghanistan by General McChrystal for one more tour. Unexpectedly, Hall is finishing that tour with a different general in charge. He's set to retire in September, for good this time. NPR's Quill Lawrence sent us this profile.
Mike Hall grew up poor outside of Cleveland, Ohio.
My dad left when I was 3 or 4. I never really knew him, you know, and then I had a couple stepdaddies. I lived with my grandma for a little while, mostly grew up on welfare. I mean, you grew up, you didn't know things were that bad. I mean, you know, as kids, you don't really know if you got it good or you got it bad until you really sort of look back.
When he stopped by a military recruiter's office right out of high school in 1976, it might have been the U.S. Army's nadir in public opinion and soldier morale. But for Hall, it was an instant family.
Now, I walked in there, and I had basically the 10 best friends I had in my life. My sergeant showed me how to shine my boots, showed me how to sew patches, showed me how to iron. You know, all those little things that just said, we care.
He joined the Rangers, which he reckons was the pillar that rebuilt the Army over the following decades, even though many of his teachers had post-traumatic disorders.
Definitely broken men from Vietnam. I mean, real war heroes, at least those drill sergeants. But there are a lot of alcohol problems and a lot of, you know, looking back, you know, we call them crazy. Now we know it's PTSD, but, you know, extreme combat veterans.
Hall isn't the Hollywood drill sergeant or the Special Forces commando with wraparound shades. He's under 6 feet and smiles more often than not. In his 50s, he seems grandfatherly to many of the young soldiers. In the past 13 months in Afghanistan, he has spent 250 days traveling outside of the NATO headquarters in Kabul, checking out how the policies from the top are playing out on the ground.
EOD.
That includes foot patrols, recently one in Aliabad in northern Afghanistan, with a platoon of soldiers living with the ANP, Afghan National Police, at an outpost that got mortared only days before his arrival.
It's tough on you guys sitting here. You're working with the AMP, they don't speak the language, they don't trust you, you don't trust them. Anybody think Afghans are dumb? If you do, you ain't been around them very long. They're extremely smart people. Most people in this country aren't good or bad. You know what they are? They're survivors. So when you get too disappointed about, you know, with who you're working with, just remember, this is a country of survivors. They've been literally at war for 31 years.
Survival means picking the side that's going to win, Hall says, adding that the Afghans can't afford to guess wrong. The soldiers need to convince them that that will be the U.S. and the Kabul government, he says.
And when you think you ain't making progress, I mean, you are. I've been here every year since this war started, and I've watched it, and we're doing things different now.
Hall came back to Afghanistan on the condition that things would be different. After 32 years of working special operations on 5 continents, he retired as a command sergeant major, the highest non-commissioned rank in the Army. A year later, an old friend, General Stanley McChrystal, took command of NATO forces in Afghanistan. Hall wrote the general an email, dropping a provocative name.
I sort of sent an email to General McChrystal. I said, you know, congratulations. If you're looking for a John Paul Vian, you know, let me know. And he said, are you serious?
John Paul Vann was an American colonel in Vietnam who later became a senior civilian advisor as the U.S. got deeper into the war. He tried to push the Army away from massive bombardment and toward counterinsurgency against the Viet Cong. Vann died when his helicopter crashed in the jungle. Vann famously said that America had not been fighting the war in Vietnam for 12 years, but for 1 year, 12 times. Hall told General McChrystal the same applied to Afghanistan.
I asked him, I said, what's your strategy? Because I've been watching this war for a while, and I knew, you know, my opinion was it wasn't going right and we weren't going to be successful. And I said, what's your strategy? And we talked about it.
After they talked, Hall took a few days to get the courage to ask his wife if he might interrupt his retirement for another 2 years in Afghanistan. He became the command sergeant major for all NATO forces and began to implement an overhaul of the Afghan strategy. But just as it got going, and before a surge of 30,000 additional U.S. troops was complete, McChrystal was forced to resign after unflattering comments about the Obama administration by him and his aides were printed in Rolling Stone magazine. Hall went back to Washington for McChrystal's retirement.
We never really talked about it. I mean, we're so close, you almost can't talk about it, you know, because what do you say to each other? But I think what it is, you know, the mission was more important than him. He could have fought it. He could have refuted all those things and made excuses. And I think the president said the same thing. The mission is more important than one man. But the sad part is the way he was portrayed in that article is just not General McChrystal. There's no man that has more integrity or more loyalty.
McChrystal and Hall had given themselves a timeline to turn Afghanistan around. In the commander's assessment from Afghanistan, written last year and leaked to the Washington Post, they included a sober warning. Quote, failure to gain the initiative and reverse insurgent momentum in the near term, next 12 months, risks an outcome where defeating the insurgency is no longer possible. 12 months later, Hall stands by that assessment.
I can't say the momentum's turned around. I'll say that when that was written in August, that I firmly believe that the insurgents have the momentum. I don't think the insurgents had the momentum now. I'm not quite sure we have the momentum. I mean, to a certain extent, we have the momentum because right now we are dictating what's going on in this country, and they're reacting to it. It's not about the insurgents. It's not about us. It's about what the people of Afghanistan think. The people don't know right now, but they're very close to the tipping point on deciding, do we have the resolve to stick this out?
Hall embodies the feeling of many inside the military who saw Iraq turn around and now think the same resources are only this summer arriving to Afghanistan. But he's aware that public opinion in the United States right now is every bit as tenuous as that of the Afghans. The consequences Hall talks about are as much for his soldiers, he says, as for Afghanistan and America.
We just can't do this in vain. And you can't tell them it's important and then just quit. Because I think it'll be close to the same results that happened to the Army after Vietnam.
Hall says he hasn't had a good day in Afghanistan. That would have to be a day without an American or Afghan or NATO soldier losing life or limb. But he has had many moments of pride. Most of them involve a soldier not firing his weapon, but using his head. On the foot patrol in Ali Abad, a lone driver approached the village. Instead of treating the man with hostility, the platoon confirmed he was a local and let the man enter, deciding he was not a suicide bomber.
It wasn't charging a machine gun bunker, but that was a life and death decision that soldier and that sergeant just made. You know, I was watching it all, and I couldn't have been prouder of how he reacted if he'd been charging a machine gun bunker, you know. Because hopefully the way we treated that whole village means he won't have to charge a machine gun bunker. I mean, that's our strategy.
Command Sergeant Major Michael T. Hall will retire, this time for good, on September 1st, and return to Tennessee to watch how the history of this war unfolds.
I'm very much a realist. I'm not an optimist. You know, I've got too many friends in Arlington, you know, too many friends with missing arms and legs and brains and souls over this, and I know it's important, but I think it is different now, and I think that it can be turned around.
Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Kabul.
Iraq is only now starting to come to terms with the war's most brutal period of sectarian violence. Some call it the Civil War, from 2006 to 2008. Many children during that time saw their own family members kidnapped, tortured, and executed. Most recently, orphanages are filling up with children orphaned by attacks from insurgent groups like Al-Qaeda. NPR's Kelly McEvers reports from Baghdad.
Hamid Abid Ali is a handsome little 12-year-old, all freckles and teeth and shiny brown hair. But he also has scabs on the side of his face from picking and scratching when he gets nervous or sad. Hamid says his mother went out for a walk one day and ended up in a hostile neighborhood of Baghdad. A few days later, the phone rang in Hamid's house. Are you Sunni or Shiite? The caller said. Hamid's father didn't answer. Well, if you don't come to pick up your wife, we'll blow her up with the other Shiites. A few days later, that's exactly what they did. Hamid's relatives told Hamid that terrorists strapped a suicide vest to his mother and detonated it.
My father, who has asthma, was crying so much from the loss of my mother. He went outside and he couldn't stand the dust. They took him to the hospital, but there was nothing they could do to help him, and he died.
Now Hamid lives at this orphanage in North Baghdad. It was opened 4 years ago by a well-respected Shiite cleric.
It's the barbershop.
Exactly. Hamid says he's happy here. He can play and laugh with his friends. But at night, when he's alone, he says he cries himself to sleep. Bershan Adil also has trouble sleeping. He watched as his father, mother, and brother were kidnapped by insurgents. He never saw them again. Bershan's answers are flat, his face deadpan. He says he doesn't even really miss his parents. After Bershan leaves the office, orphanage director Abu Jaffer tells us the boy has a violent streak. that he hits other kids and calls them names.
So whenever we see him in such situation, of course, we do follow certain techniques or ways just to absorb his anger. For instance, either to embrace him, to have him in our lap, or sometimes we bring a story or a certain chatting with him just to make him think of something else, just to ease him down, just to absorb his anger.
In some ways, this is the way you deal with things here, Iraqis say. When something bad happens, the best thing to do is try and forget it. But in other ways, the kids here aren't dealing with the violence because there's no one who's trained to help them do it. The director himself has a military background. He admits his staff lacks the proper education and that an orphanage that serves 60 kids is barely scratching the surface in a country where millions of children have lost their parents to violence. One place where children can seek treatment is this ward in the government-run Children's Hospital. It's headed by Haider al-Maliki, one of only a handful of child psychiatrists in the whole country. Children come here for evaluations, therapy, and sometimes drugs. Maliki's own research suggests that nearly three-quarters of Iraq's children suffer from symptoms related to post-traumatic stress disorder. He says violence is so commonplace here, people have come to think it's normal.
Our children and even our families have adapted the situation. It is okay for them to see some of them being killed or injured or threatening, and after a few minutes, everything is returned to normal.
The plan is for Maliki to train more psychiatrists and counselors and open a separate clinic just for child psychiatry. The new clinic has been approved by the government, but the funding has yet to come through. Maliki says the more children suppress their experiences, the worse off society will be.
So we think our generation, there will be after 10 to 15 years, when they will grow into adults, they will be a violent population.
I've said it many times, but I'll say it again, Maliki says. With this war, you got rid of one Saddam, but you created a million Saddams. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Baghdad.
Coming up, Fidel Castro reemerges, and wine lovers find a new use for vino.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
Fidel Castro turned 84 on Friday, August the 13th. It's been nearly 4 years since he turned over Cuba's leadership to his younger brother, Raul, withdrawing from public view after undergoing emergency surgery. Now he's back, making almost daily appearances on Cuban TV and still throwing political curveballs. Nick Miroff reports from Havana.
Fidel Castro is convinced that U.S. and Israeli tensions with Iran are driving the world toward nuclear war, and he wants everyone to know it, so he's been talking about the subject all over town, even during a recent visit to the Havana Aquarium. Over the weekend, he convened a special session of Cuba's parliament, urging President Obama to stave off Armageddon. Obama won't give the order to attack if we persuade him not to, Castro told the audience. A lot of people are with us in the effort. We're here to make our contribution. Castro walked with the help of an aide, but he was expressive and alert when he spoke, banging the podium for emphasis and animating his ideas with his huge hands. The 11-minute speech was uncharacteristically short, and in the question period that followed, he referred to the Russians as Soviets and called their country the USSR. But for the most part, he seemed sharp for a man of his age. He even got in a few licks against old foes in Washington that he's long outlived. What's going to happen to this world? Castro asked rhetorically. The empire is coming to an end, and making war is no longer a way for the empire to sustain itself. At least Obama isn't Nixon, who was a cynic, because the United States has had presidents who were either cynics or ignorant fools, like Reagan, Castro added. The delegates in the vast assembly hall mostly took turns praising Castro's return and his improved health. Like many Cubans, they seemed to treat him as a grandfatherly figure, cheering him on and smiling through his grim warnings of apocalypse.
Viva nuestro comandante jefe. Viva la patria. Viva nuestra revolución.
The Castro family has Cuba watchers puzzled these days, wondering which brother is really calling the shots. So far, Fidel has avoided commenting on the island's domestic concerns, holding forth instead on foreign matters like global warming, the Obama presidency, and now atomic warfare. Miriam Leyva is a former Cuban diplomat who's now a dissident writer and activist in Havana.
He has determined the life of Cubans and all that is going on in Cuba for almost 50 years, so he can't be away from that. It's incredible what he's using. He wants to preserve humanity from a third world war. And in 1962, Fidel Castro put the world at the verge of a third world war.
Unlike Leyva, most Cubans today were born after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Castro rule is all they know. Leyva thinks most Cubans are wary of Fidel's return, concerned that he'll further delay his brother's slow-moving economic reforms. As usual, though, it's hard to gauge how Cubans really feel. On summer nights, entire families come here to Havana's Malecón seawall, drink rum, hear music, and escape their sweltering apartments. Few care to talk about politics, but Ramon Gonzalez, an electrical engineer, said seeing Castro on TV again just seemed like a return to normalcy. Gonzalez said that even though Cubans haven't seen Castro in years, he's doing the same things he did before, even though now he's supposedly no longer running the country. Gonzalez said he thinks Castro is regaining the same influence he used to have. Castro has also reemerged in time to do some book promotion. His 833-page memoir, The Strategic Victory, is coming out this month, chronicling his childhood and his rebel army's rise to power in the late 1950s, and he's already working on a second volume. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff in Havana.
And now for a little rejuvenation. NPR's Silvia Pagioli is going to take us away to the Italian region of Umbria. It's known as the green heart of the country, covered by miles and miles of vineyards. Winemaking in the region dates back to antiquity, when wine was also known for its therapeutic properties. And Sylvia visited an Umbrian town where what was old is new again.
The medieval town of Torgiano looms over gentle hills lined with row after row of vineyards. Winemaking has existed here since the time of the Etruscans, and Torgiano hosts a unique museum that traces the central role of wine in the economy and culture of the Mediterranean world. It's the creation of Maria Grazia Lungarotti.
We all made wine more or less the way the Romans did until the Second World War. It all changed with modern machines and technology.
Maria Grazia is the widow of the founder of the Lungarotti winery, the biggest in the region. An art historian by training, she has collected nearly 3,000 items that illustrate how wine has accompanied mankind for millennia. In the museum cellar, there's an 18th-century wine press which follows the design of the ancient Roman author Cato the Elder, a type of press still in use as recently as 60 years ago. The displays alternate between the sacred and the profane, ceremonial bronze pieces and glassware from ancient Greece, alongside medieval and Renaissance winemaking tools. A large section is dedicated to rare books, engravings, and apothecary jars, which illustrate the many uses of wine in medicine and cosmetics. And now, visitors to Torgiano have the chance to experience those old methods put into practice. It's called wine therapy.
Vino therapy spa is called Bella Uve because Bella is Bella everywhere. In every language you understand the meaning, and Uve because it's from the grape.
Teresa Severini is the daughter of Maria Grazia Lungarotti and one of Italy's first female enologists. She says the idea of using wine for wellness goes way back.
Many centuries ago, where you can find recipes to have a good skin, good health. Still today, if you go into the country, you can find people immersing the legs in the wine when they are tired, or doing a massage on the scalp because of the good properties of wine.
Over the centuries, wine has been used as an antiseptic and a sedative to alleviate depression, hypertension, gout, and rheumatism. Recent studies suggest the compound resveratrol found in the skin of red grapes might have magical anti-aging properties. The spa has revived the ancient use of grapes and wine to make unguents, perfumes, and soaps applied with modern massage methods. Every treatment uses a specific wine for foot massages, facials, or body peelings. Masseuse Emanuela Minella starts filling a wooden tub that looks like a wine cask. As she adds 3 liters of Sangiovese red, she describes the treatment called the Wave of Bacchus.
We start the wine therapy with a scrub, massage with a cream with wine, and after bath in a wine. After the bath in a wine, you feel energized because the wine activates the circulation, is antioxidant, and relaxing the muscles.
Menella says all the treatments are just modern versions of what a person like Cleopatra would have been accustomed to.
She did the bath in a wine, the bath with the milk for moisturizing her skin. So we take the old treatment. Here in Umbria we have all product, all natural product. Why not use that?
Many of the treatments available at the spa derive from what in centuries past were known as books of secrets, books filled with beauty aids and remedies for everyday ailments written by women for other women. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.